97.1 FM Talk. On-demand audio.
Do a little bit of something different here just because of the breaking news. So you guys just hang out with your headphones, and I'm going to visit with my friend Phil Holloway, who is the host of the Megyn Kelly True Crime Show. And we have a mistrial, Phil, that has finally been declared in this crazy case that we've been following for weeks now. How are you this afternoon?
I'm doing great. I hope you are, my friend.
I am. I just listened to Kevin Reddington's news conference. He feels like he won this case. He feels like, he had 11 jurors on his side. There was the one holdout. They couldn't come to an agreement with that holdout, so the judge really did. The only thing he could do is declare a mistrial. It looks like maybe they're going to try this again. I mean, Kevin said he'd be willing to try it again with a jury. He could go to a judge trial if, in fact, it was second-degree murder. But thoughts on what happened today, Phil?
Well, this was, I'm not surprised that it was a hung jury, but I am surprised that he was as close to an outright acquittal, or at least a not guilty by reason of insanity, as he was. In fact, he had 11 votes, but he had 12 jurors who had doubts. And that was the issue today was this juror who apparently admitted in the jury room that he had doubts, but he refused to follow the judge's instructions that say, hey, look, if you have those kind of doubts, it is your duty to acquit. And so it's not really optional. And so that was what the fuss was about today. Reddington wanted that juror who was not following instructions, wanted him off. And they wanted him to be replaced by an alternate because yesterday, when that note came out yesterday, Reddington knew because the note said this one person just won't vote for not guilty. So he knew how close they were.
Yeah, and so he had one Hail Mary that he threw this morning. I mean, the mistrial was basically declared, and then he asked for permission to try to get a stay, and that just didn't work. It took a couple hours. The judge actually said, we're going to give you an hour. I think in the end, it took 2 hours, and that didn't come through. So now they move forward, and there are some things that are going to happen post-trial. But it does seem, by every indication so far, that they may try this case again, Phil.
They might, but here's the thing. Kevin Reddington was not necessarily playing the game that you think he was playing, because if he objects to a mistrial and a mistrial is granted over the defense objection, the Constitution, and particularly our body of law as it pertains to double jeopardy, says that you cannot have a retrial after a mistrial that was done over the defendant's objection unless the mistrial was what we call a manifest necessity. So it's when the defense opposes the mistrial, it's harder. You got to justify it. So he's going to file a special kind of an appeal. It's called a plea in bar. And he's going to say, look, you can't have another, you can't try her again because it would be unconstitutional double jeopardy. And so that is going to have to work its way through the trial court and then up through the appeals court probably as well. And at the same time, he's got incredible bargaining power now. He's got, a trial behind him that even with everything the state threw at it, they had 12 people who actually had, serious doubt and 11 who wanted to cut her loose on a not guilty by reason of insanity. So as forceful as the prosecutor was at his press conference and emotional, I think that he needs to kind of take a breath, come back next week when he's not worked up, and make a practical decision about whether they want to try her again or try to work out some other kind of deal with the defense.
Did you hear Kevin Reddington rip the juror pretty significantly in his post-trial remarks here a short time ago? I mean, he basically said, I hope he can sleep at night.
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously upset about it. And this might be what we call a stealth juror, which is people who get on a jury and regardless of what they think about the evidence, you usually see it in the context of just, guilt or innocence. Somebody will hold out, they will be a stealth juror, and they will go on that jury with an agenda to keep someone from being convicted. So we see it sometimes the other way around, but a stealth juror is one that doesn't follow the law and they vote in a certain way because they have some kind of certain agenda. And it seems to me that maybe Clancy believes that this person was such a stealth juror.
Yeah, we also have civil trials in the works as well, so this is not going away. Phil, thanks for the help this week as always. I really appreciate it. Have a very good Labor Day weekend.
You as well, my friend.
All right, take care. That's Phil Holloway, is the host of the Megyn Kelly True Crime Show. We have a couple of people in the studio, probably couldn't be better panelists, in Tim Fitch and Ted House here, because you guys both know the law. You are a judge, Ted. I mean, I'll start with you, Chief Fitch. It's just a horrible, horrible circumstance. And I've had empathy for the, you know, the mental health aspect of this because of my experience with mental health. But I also have a big problem in not focusing on these victims, you know, where I think Cora Dawson and Kellen, I like to, you know, mention their names because I think it's important. And there are a lot of people out there that feel like she just got off scot-free when she's a very evil person. So people are very split on this across the country.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I will tell you, I think if this suspect was the father and not the mother, the verdict would have been much different. There is a lot of sympathy, and I've had a front row seat to mental illness my entire career. And to see this in person, I have a family member that had postpartum depression, and meds were messed up, and there was a suicide attempt and things like that. And so I do have some. But however, there are three dead children here, and someone has to speak for those kids, and someone has to say what she did was wrong, and that hasn't happened yet. So we'll have to see. But I will tell you, if you just looked at some of the spectators outside the courtroom and some of the comments, I don't know if you saw the DA's speech today, basically. You had hecklers in there, and, you know, why didn't you protect the kids before she killed them, and why weren't you concerned? I mean, it was all of that. Probably some of the same people we saw at Luigi Mangione's appearances in New York, same kind of concept where they feel sympathy for that. And we're seeing more and more of that.
Yeah, look, I think that there's extremes on both sides here. I mean, the people that are cheerleading for Lindsey Clancy, that baffles me, considering the nature of this crime. On the other hand, I do think that there's people on the other side that are condemning her without having the ability to have a little empathy for what might have happened. And by the way, Kevin Reddington did a pretty good job in those weeks leading up to closing arguments to try to prove his case. And I think by evidence of where the jury was, he almost had a victory here. His closing arguments, Ted, I don't know if you saw those. I reread those yesterday. Not very good. He was very all over the place and scattered. But what are your thoughts? Because you've been a judge before. You've seen probably juries deadlocked. This has been a fascinating just exercise in legality here in America.
Well, Mark, I've tried a lot of jury trials, and I know Tim Fitch has been involved in a lot of criminal jury trials. It's the judge's job to maintain the decorum in the courtroom, of course. They can't necessarily control what goes on outside of the courtroom. But in order to secure a conviction in a criminal case, the state has to prove that the defendant committed every element of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is proof that leaves you firmly convinced of the defendant's guilt. It does not require proof that overcomes every possible doubt. I'm pretty surprised in this case that the judge let the trial go on as long as he did. What was it, 7 days of deliberation?
7 days of deliberation,
that's
yeah.
A long time, yeah, in a criminal trial. And I don't think I ever would have let that trial go on that long, because you really do risk getting reversed on appeal if you do that. And if it's a hung jury, then it's a mistrial, and apparently the judge ultimately decided to do the right thing.
A lot of people were questioning whether or not, and I've seen sequestered juries and non-sequestered juries, but this was not a sequestered jury. And then I can't remember, is there a possibility, this may be state to state, can you have a non-sequestered jury for the trial and then sequester them for deliberations?
You can do that. It's unusual.
Is it unusual to you that they weren't sequestered in this case or not?
No, I think sequestration is an extreme situation. You don't want to do it unless you absolutely have to protect the rights of the victims and the defendant and the state as well. So I'm not surprised there was no sequestration in this case.
Chief, you know, we were talking about this, all three of us, before the show, and, you know, the judge made it very well known this morning that he had a lot of, you know, he was thanking the jury over and over. He wanted to do it even in person, and I think he did. He asked permission to come into the room and thank them in person. But it's a jury that went through 7 weeks, 7 days of these hard deliberations. I'm sure that jury room was very, very tense, and there were a lot of emotions involved. I thought the judge, by the way, Judge Sullivan in this case, did a really, really good job. I thought that he was very effective in trying to manage all this. But it's crazy to me that you have the two sides that are so divided on this and seemingly not able to see anything through each side. And that's kind of where the country is right now.
No doubt.
Unfortunately, that speaks volumes about where we are, right?
Yeah, no doubt about that. And you know what I don't know is, was there a change of venue on this?
No, there wasn't. And, you know, that's another thing I think that was questioned earlier this week or throughout these conversations. But one of the things I want to circle back to, something I forgot to make a point on, because you've seen crime scene photos. You've seen crime scenes, okay?
Right.
And as a judge, same thing, Ted, with you, right? I have covered murder trials. I've seen evidence in murder trials and things like that. But what these jurors and really what that whole courtroom had to go through in seeing these pictures and hearing the calls and hearing the screams, all that stuff, I don't know how a jury gets through that, honestly, because you're going to be affected by that. I don't care who you are.
It's bad. They'll be affected the rest of their lives. You know, I saw many child deaths in my career. And one of the worst things to do when I was in homicide is we had to go to the autopsies of all the murder victims. And there's nothing worse than seeing an autopsy of a child, especially at the time I had two children little myself. There's nothing worse than that. And I don't know that you ever get through that. So these jurors will be profoundly affected by this. And I think that's why the judge really wanted to spend some time with them to let them know, you know, what services are available to them and those type of things after seeing this and living with this for all those weeks.
Because I think they're going to need some help.
No doubt.
I always met with jurors after every trial and sometimes had to explain to jurors, you know, I understand the psychological trauma that you have endured. And I would also explain to them, though, that to some extent, that's the price of liberty. That's the price of freedom in our country because of the United States Constitution granting the right to a jury trial. And a jury trial requires jurors.
Yeah.
And that's just where we are. But certainly it's good for the state to make services available to those jurors who may need those.
And what you just said, Ted, is really, I think Judge Sullivan said the same thing a couple of different times this week about, you know, when he was thanking the jurors for their service, but also reminding them that, you know, they're playing a very important role. And I think my experience, you guys would know a lot better than me, but, you know, juries are hard to predict, right? I always tell this story of a case that I covered in Boone County, and this was before cell phones, right? And the courthouse was right next to this place called Boone Tavern where we all hung out. Ted, you probably know Boone Tavern, right? And the jury goes into deliberations, and I think most of us, including the prosecutor and defense, thought this was going to be a fairly long deliberation. We barely sat down to order lunch at Boone Tavern and a note came over that they were in. I mean, it was like 15 or 20 minutes. So that's just an example of how juries are unpredictable and you don't know exactly where they're going to go. I mean, think about this, and I talked about this a little bit yesterday. There's not many places that are as secret as a jury room in this country, right? I mean, the jurors can come out. I don't think there was a gag order. So I think they're able to speak freely if they want to. But then the question is, do you want to draw attention to yourself, right?
Yeah, because you know there's going to be people against you.
No matter what.
And no matter what. No matter what side you take.
All right, speaking of that, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We had a big court decision by the Missouri Supreme Court yesterday that's going to affect or potentially may affect the election in November. There are certainly two divided sides on all of this. We'll get to it next. It's a Reardon Roundtable on a Friday. Tim Fitch, Ted House on my panel.
Get more at 971talk.com.